The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we'll be discussing, in the second part of our program, the epidemic of overdiagnosis in American medicine, which in turn leads to overtreatment, overtesting, and a national health crisis. I'll be joined by Professor Gilbert Welch, who is recognized as the top expert in medical screening. He's professor of medicine at Dartmouth University Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And we'll be talking about that. I believe that we should have no-fault medical insurance in the United States, and we'll get into that as we go on. Also today, we'll be taking a look at some serious issues. A commentary from Professor John Causey on the media in America. It sells views. It does not commit itself to objective journalism. And what are the consequences? Also, the latest on genetically modified food. A doctor, a scientist in mainstream science medicine in England is suggesting, let's just call it vaccinated food. Okay, and that seems to be the campaign. And they think that's terrific. Also, the latest on vitamin D, fluoride, and vaccines. The common theme from ANH USA. They have some feelings about this, and I'll share that. And from Robert Scheer from Truthdig, Obama pulls a Clinton. Well, I don't think that's the case. I believe that Obama is Clinton, and I think that we should have seen this all along. I remember once at the beginning of the Clinton administration, or when he was still candidate, Doug Henderson, who, congratulations, Doug, he has a best-selling book out there, said, give him a chance. And I said, I'm happy to give him a chance. But you'll know him by what he does. So separate out the rhetoric from who he supports, which institutions. Well, now we see that, and we'll deal with that. So we have a lot to share with you. Let's begin. I'm opposed to the regular use of antibiotics because they defect our immune system and make us more susceptible to different types of conditions. In fact, there's what's called a hyper-antibiotic reactions where we're taking so many antibiotics that within we do get something that we could benefit from an antibiotic, it super infections occur because we build up a resistance. Here's the latest. This is from, quote, a research team looked at 580,000 children over an eight-year period and reported on the outcome in the peer-reviewed journal Gut. They showed that antibiotics up irritable bowel syndrome risk. Now, why is this important? Because, quite simply, we have a lot of people suffering from irritable bowel, and they don't know why. And once you get this, it can really play havoc in your life. In fact, one of the people I counseled was having to watch where the bathrooms were because they'd frequently have to go to the bathroom 15 or 20 times a day because of irritable bowel. Then when asked, how often do you check with, you know, to see if you're having any antibiotics? Oh, I had antibiotics all the time. Everything, it was an antibiotic. A sore throat, antibiotic. A cold, flu, antibiotics. Well, hold on, those are viral in nature, not bacterial. Didn't matter. We have grossly overprescribed antibiotics for everything. Plus, people are getting antibiotics, smaller amounts, in the meat and dairy they're consuming. So if we want to clean up our bowel, let's get probiotics, healthy, good bacteria, and really only use an antibiotic if it's absolutely, positively necessary. Eating, and by the way, there are natural antibiotics, like bee propolis. You take bee propolis and olive leaf extract. and wild oregano oil, and Echinacea polyarco, colloidal silver, you've done far more in a good way to kill bacteria and viruses than any antibiotic could ever do, without the harmful side effects. So we should be going in that direction. Blueberries. I talk about them a lot because I believe we should be consuming blueberries, in fact, all berries, for their flavonoids. Here is the latest research on all of you who are having your berry compounds. You're ahead of the curve again. New research from the University of East Anglia and Harvard University show that eating blueberries can guard against high blood pressure. Now, the new findings revealed the bioactive component in blueberries, which is a proanthocyanidins, and they offer protection, the same protection, by the way, that grapes offer against hypertension. And compared with those who did not eat blueberries, those eating at least one serving a week reduced the risk of developing the condition by 10%. All right, one serving per week. What if we had one serving per day? So if we reduce it by 10%, if we have it one in 7 days, does that mean we reduce it by 70% if we had it once a day? And what if we had other known, very powerful flavonoid berries along with that? What if we also had strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, goji, acai, mangosteen? Does that mean we would have zero chance of having high blood pressure? It's just a mathematical extrapolation, but it makes sense. Now, we know that anthocyanidins belong to the bioactive family of compounds called flavonoids. And they are very, very important. We get them from black currants, very high, raspberries, blood oranges, and blueberries. Now, other flavonoids are found in all the other fruits and grains and herbs, and the flavonoids present in green tea, black tea, oolong tea, white tea, and fruit juices, red wine, dark chocolate. We know that all those reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. This is the first large study to investigate the effects of different flavonoids on hypertension. Now, the team at Harvard and the other university studied 134,000 women and 7,000 men from the Harvard Cohort Nurses Health Study and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study of Doctors for 14 years. And so they took a look at all these people, none of whom had high blood pressure at the beginning of the study, and then they started looking at what made the difference. And what made the difference is those who ate the most berries. So, for those of you taking in your red berry powders, you're way, way ahead of this, and one more reason why you've been doing the right thing all along. From the American Journal of Public Health, there is an inverse benefit due to drug marketing. What does that mean in lay language? Well, from Science Daily, this is mainstream science saying the following. Drugs that the pharmaceutical companies advertise every hour on television, the ones that are most aggressively marketed to physicians and patients, quote, offer the least benefit and are the most harmful to the patient. That's a phenomenon described as inverse benefit law. That was published at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston and appeared in the American Journal of Public Health. Quote, this is not a random occurrence, but rather a repeating planned scenario in which drugs discovered with good science for a specific set of patients are marketed to a larger population as necessary, beneficial, and safer than other alternatives, but it doesn't work. So what you have to look for is the more they're aggressively promoting something, the less likely it is to really benefit anyone. In fact, it's more likely to hurt you. That's what they're saying. Now, if they're saying this, then wouldn't you assume then that immediately there would be an effort to stop all this mass marketing of all these sleeping pills and anti-inflammatories and heart and statins? No. The fact that there is good independent science showing that we're over-marketing and the over-marketing is causing all these problems is not being dealt with on any level. For a long time, many individuals in this audience have been concerned about multiple chemicals in our environment, and that these chemicals, some banned long ago, some not banned, end up in small amounts, and that can play havoc with our hormones, our immune system. An industry that controls the debate, and because they control the EPA and the regulatory agencies in Congress, and they have enormous influence over the media, say not to worry. And they even send people out from front groups with PhDs and MDs saying, these people who say that you should watch what you eat, and these are just alarmists, pay no attention to them, they're not credible. Here's the latest from Science Daily, as reported in Environmental Health Perspectives. Quote, 99% of pregnant women in the United States test positive for multiple chemicals, including banned ones. The bodies of virtually all, every single U.S. pregnant woman carries multiple chemicals, and some of those were banned in the 1970s, and others used in common products, such as nonstick cookware, processed foods, personal care products. That's according to the latest study, University of California, San Francisco. And the study marks the first time that the number of chemicals in pregnant women are exposed and has actually been counted. How many they find? In the average pregnant woman, 163 toxic different chemicals. Everything from the PCBs, the polychlorinated biphenyls, and the organochlorine pesticides, and the phenols, and polybrominated diphenyl ethers, and phthalates. All of these are in every pregnant woman. And by the way, that biphenyl A makes plastics hard and clear. You find them in epoxy resins, used to line the inside of metal food and beverage cans, and they were in 96% of the women surveyed. So, here's the issue. During fetal development, anything that's in the woman's blood can have an adverse effect upon the developing fetus and lead to preterm birth, birth defects, childhood death, miscarriages, or if they make it through that, they can end up with all forms of problems as they develop. And yet we've had Congress, all of our major institutions, say this isn't a problem. Not one major public government institution has been aggressive in saying, let us get these out of all products. They are dangerous, not once. So now the studies are in. Now we have proof positive. If you're a woman and you're pregnant, you have 163 minimum toxic chemicals in your body. It's going to adversely affect your fetus. No one gives a damn about you, especially not this administration that's never met a drug that it couldn't embrace, a pharmaceutical company, a major corporate polluter that it couldn't defend. But who's interested in you and your developing fetus? How about nobody in government? Just so we're clear on all this, we're giving you the facts, but nothing will be done about it by this or any other administration, because we know that they are all adversely affected. And this is another study that just came in. I was just looking at this morning. Couch potatoes, beware. Too much time spent watching TV is harmful to your heart. More than 2 hours a day of watching television increases your risk of heart disease. This is from the American College of Cardiology. Let me quote this. Spending too much leisure time in front of a TV or a computer appears to dramatically increase the risk of heart disease and premature death from any cause, regardless of how much exercise one gets, according to a new study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Data shows that compared to people who spend less than 2 hours each day on screen-based entertainment, like watching TV or using a computer playing video games, those who devote more than 4 hours to these activities are more than twice as likely to have a major cardiac event that involves hospitalization or death or both. So, University College London did the study. Quote, our analysis suggests that 2 or more hours of screen time each day may place someone at greater risk of cardiac event. Okay. So what we have to do is we have to get away from the television, away from the video games, get outside, and exercise and play and do it right. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with commentary as guest coming up on over-diagnosing and over-treating. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go to some of the commentaries. Vitamin D fluoride and vaccines. Here's what they say. Short commentary. If government is going to act as a scientific arbiter, it needs to have clean hands. That means getting private commercial interests out of the decision-making process. In this week's Vitamin D update, we discuss the glaring conflict of interest in the recent Institute of Medicine report on vitamin D. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated case. Consider also the recent fluoride debacle. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention calls fluoride in drinking water, quote, one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. Except earlier this month, they stated that the levels they previously mandated are too high, and the Health and Human Services and EPA are taking steps to prevent excessive exposure to it. Children's teeth are getting pitted and turning black and brown permanently from dental fluorosis. An increasing number of scientists and health professors argue that fluoride exposure has a negative impact on the whole body, including joint pain, hypothyroidism, kidney and liver damage, and bone cancer. What led to the high fluoride levels initially recommended? The government was spurred on by private interests wanting to sell fluoride as a byproduct from the aluminum smelting process. This is often the problem. Private interests influencing the government at the people's expense. It's crony capitalism at its most destructive. This approach is especially worrisome with regard to vaccines, especially flu vaccines. The government has increasingly become a full partner with pharmaceutical companies in the production of vaccines, which creates a huge conflict of interest. Government produces, distributes, recommends, evaluates, requires by law in the case of kids, and then judges the results. No wonder the government won't tell us how many cases of flu occur in vaccinated individuals. Apparently, it doesn't think that information is worth gathering. No wonder. It's likely to be very embarrassing. We need to stop the censorship of scientific evidence. It's the only way the truth will come out. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, the author of the controversial British study linking autism vaccines, was accused this month by the British Medical Journal of perpetrating an elaborate fraud. It was an undeniable small study, only 12 patients. And while his basic premise still has support, there has been a concerted effort to destroy Dr. Wakefield and make everyone afraid to touch the issue for the foreseeable future. Wakefield's study should absolutely be criticized, but in an open, collegial, and academic manner. Don't like the results? See procedural errors? Fine. But the answer is to do more scientific research on the subject, not less. Do more studies with a broader patient sampling. This is what the peer review process, the whole scientific method, is about. If the MMR vaccine is safe for children, then demonstrate it. The treatment of Dr. Wakefield is too much like the Salem witch trials for our comfort. End quote. Okay, two corrections here. First, let's be very clear. So this message for the ANH USA. At no time did Dr. Wakefield or any of the doctors and scientists evaluating the 12 children ever state or write or even suggest there was an association between the MMR vaccine and autism. So you're wrong on your facts. Secondly, why start out that Wakefield's study should be absolutely criticized? Why? Why should it absolutely be criticized? What exactly is in the study? I've read it. Have you? I doubt it. Because had you actually read the study, you would see that all that Wakefield and the other scientists, all board certified, and in pediatrics, found was that there were inflammatory reactions inside of the intestines of those who had received the MMR vaccine. A, every one of those scientists was pro-vaccine, including Andrew Wakefield. what they suggested was that until such time that this could be further studied, which is what they suggested, then have individual components, have the measles, then the mumps, and then the rubella parts of the vaccine given over a period of time. The British government then forbid all individual vaccines, supporting only the combined vaccine. Now, you ask a basic question. What is the basis of the MMR vaccine? We've done the homework. On tomorrow's program, I'll be having as many of the 12 parents on, of those children, as possible. Plus, we'll have a whistleblower that no one's heard of before, from inside at the very top level of the British legal system. I will say no more than that, except that we will reveal truths that show the entire system in Britain is itself suspect for how special private interest, wealthy interest, including pharmaceutical interests, can manipulate official government policy, can manipulate the media, and can manipulate the British Medical Journal and what is given to the public. So the real issue here is where you correctly mentioned the problem with fluoride, on the one hand saying it's this great achievement, and now saying, oops, it was a great achievement. Yes, prove it. You can't. There is no evidence to it. It was not a great achievement. But now you're recognizing that you have permanently stained one in every four children's teeth in the United States. Oh, so you mean you got it wrong. I see. So for the last 65 years, you have said that we should have one part per million of fluoride. Now you're saying too much. What about all the other studies that show that that can lead to cancer and other conditions? Do your homework. Read the article that is the most definitive, science-based article as honest journalism called The Fluoride Fiasco. It's on GaryNull.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. But otherwise, I fully agree with the rest of your theme that the Institute of Medicine is not honest. Now to this issue of what do we do with genetically engineered food? Well, we're going to have Jeffrey Smith on showing you the latest on all of the reasons we should not be consuming genetically modified food. But here's something. Quote, the controversy over genetically modified food was reignited after one of Britain's top agricultural scientists suggested farmers should rename genetically modified crops as vaccinated in a bid to win over the public to a controversial technology. What is their suggestion here? Well, Bill Clark, who runs the Broome's Barn Research Center, which is part of the Rothamsted Research, said rename genetically modified as vaccinated because that way will win over, quote, millions of families, the majority of whom are skeptical of outright or hostile about genetically modified foods, but are completely supportive of vaccinations. That's interesting. Clearly, they're unaware of how dangerous vaccines are, but that's that. And finally, before we go into our studio, from Robert Shear for a social commentary section of our program. And by the way, thank you for sending in your commentaries and your essays. Any area of life that you see we have a problem and are not addressing it in a way that you believe is right, send us the problem and, more importantly, the solution in an essay. And after we read it, we will put it on the air and post it on our website. It's something new that we're allowing a forum for expression for anyone in this audience. You'll send those to Karalee@GaryNull.com. K-A-R-A-L-E-E. At GaryNull.com. The first of these I'll be reading will be on Friday, and it will be from Christina D'Amico, an elementary school teacher who wrote, Can We Fix Our Failing Schools? I read this, and I was extremely impressed because she gives us insights that just hit it right, and we need to hear what she has to say. I want to hear what you have to say on any aspect of life that can empower us. This is a very brief from Robert Shear. Quote, here we go again. When Bill Clinton suffered an electoral reversal after his first 2 years in office, he abruptly embraced the corporate money guys who had financed his congressional opposition in an effort to purchase a second term. In a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, Barack Obama veered sharply down that same course, trumpeting his executive order, quote, to remove outdated regulations that stifle job creation and make our economy less competitive, unquote. That was yesterday, by the way. He employed the same, quote, creating a 21st century regulatory system, unquote, rationalized by Bill Clinton when he signed off on the sweeping deregulation legislation that unleashed the Wall Street greed that ended up being the biggest job killer since the Great Depression. So now what we have, in just lay language, we have the President of the United States wanting to do the same thing as Bill Clinton did to so-called modernize our Commodity Future Modernization Act that Clinton signed, and that means that all the financial derivatives will no longer be under any government control and the credit default swaps. So now President Obama is simply allowing, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, the, quote, a lack of proper oversight and transparency that nearly led to the collapse of financial markets and full-scale depression. But Obama now promises that his deregulation efforts will be more sensibly targeted and will, quote, bring order and regulations back. And how's he going to do this? He's going to surround himself with a panel of people who will help revamp this, quote, with more input from experts and business citizens. Mm-hmm. And who are his two top people to oversee President Obama's deregulation of Wall Street? Tom Donilon, Obama's national security advisor, who was the Washington lobbyist for the housing behemoth Fannie Mae, which will cost taxpayers $700 billion because of its marketing of toxic derivatives, and Obama's new chief of staff, William Daley, was the lead Washington representative for a similarly afflicted J.P. Morgan Chase. They are the folks, along with many other Wall Street alums in this administration, who will oversee the latest update of the already weakened regulations. And the first target will be the administration's puny efforts to protect consumers. Quote, the move is the latest effort by the White House to repair relations with corporate America. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. So what this means in lay language is that President Obama is completely sold out to Wall Street and corporate America, and any regulations they don't like will be cast aside, just like Clinton did. As a result, we ended up with Wall Street run amok, greed on a level never seen in human history, and now whatever few little laws or rules help protect us are going to be washed aside with a smile and a wave. How unfortunate. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall on the road. Tomorrow we're filming, start at 8 a.m. in Los Angeles. Look forward to seeing some of you who will be coming by to assist there. This is an email from Marianne, and Mariana says, quote, subject, dangerous TB tests being forced on healthcare workers and students. Message, why the hell would I want anything to do with any chemical company? My job is now forcing a TB test. I train people on non-invasive rehab equipment. This test injects phenol, a known carcinogen, into the skin. This is known to cause skin cancer in animals. Also, supposedly dead TB virus is injected into the skin. Do I have any faith in a chemical company to do anything safely? What is their quality control for that? As if that could ever be okay. Oops, sorry, that was a live virus we just gave you. Anyway, Vaccine Liberation talks about a non-invasive TB test with biomeridian.com. That is FDA approved. I just spoke with Frank over there. He told me of some chiropractors out there in Jersey that have this test devised. Will my company accept a test by a chiropractor? I doubt it. I would see the guy with the bone in his nose and pulling herbs from a tree before I could trust Western MDs. But my company would probably not accept a test by a chiropractor. Okay, that's just put out there. I like to this is just one of the people in the audience who's out there giving these TB tests and telling us what they know is going into that test and why they consider it dangerous. And so if anyone knows of a non-destructive TB test, let us know and we'll pass this message on. And by the way, before you challenge what naturalists and what medicine doctors and what bush doctors and others who are in their own population helping to heal, probably 90% of all the pharmaceuticals that we see that have any aspect of a plant in them, how do you think they got that information? It came from those very people that you would not trust that have used these medicinal plants for the millennium. Whether it's a shaman, or how do you think we got acai? How do you think we got foxglove? How do you think we got the drugs to make digitalis and all these other things? These are from Native Americans. Who told us about echinacea? Native Americans. Hundreds of Native American plants in South American, African, Asian. So pull back on some of the highly racist, insensitive statement. Deal with the facts at hand. Do not denigrate what you do not know. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go and say hello to Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, I have a couple more articles that I thought would be interesting. And the first one here is about college students and how they're not learning to think critically from college and are actually still very easily swayed by political spin and emotions. And I just thought maybe you could have some extra input that you could add on to this article.
Run that by me again. I want to see the context of the question.
Well, the article is based around the fact that kids are going to college, and while they're, you know, getting a formal education, none of it is actually having to do with their ability to interpret emotion, and are still easily swayed by political spin in stories. And so, you know, the question really becomes, how do you think this is failing on college's education system?
Well, it depends upon the nature of the school, the teacher, the curriculum, how it's taught, and the interest of the student to accept what is being taught, but not accept it in a monotheistic way, that this is the only truth, that what I'm reading or what I'm being told. Because otherwise, you'll have people coming out of some of the religious colleges believing in the debate between evolutionary science and creationist science. Some people believe that we had Tyrannosaurus rex and all the reptiles and all the alligators and all the great sharks on Noah's Ark. Absurd as that may seem, they have justified it by constant indoctrination. And also, if they challenge many of these creationist principles, they would have failed the class. Others understand that this is just information that's been shared with them because of true belief, and that's a part of the politicalization of their curriculum. Others, let's say, and that would be a religious school person, if they can differentiate and separate out what they learn. No different than when I was going to dietetics school. I would sit in dietetics class, and I would have a teacher who was morbidly obese, and most of the students were as well, tell us that if you have a cancer patient, and the dietitian's one who actually has to put together the eating plan. The doctor prescribes it, but you have to create it. You could just give them 400 calories of fat from an oil. Or you can give them 600 calories of glucose from a sugar. So when I raised a question, but you're suggesting all carbohydrates or all, let's say, mucopolysaccharides are the same. They are not. And I gave the example, if you took the amount of sugar, glucose, and fructose that's in an apple, that would be equivalent to about 2 teaspoons of sugar. Do you think that the person is going to benefit the same with 2 teaspoons of sugar directly in their blood or eating an apple? Well, it's all the same, the teacher told me. Now, after being sent to the director's office 6 times in 1 month, all because I simply politely asked questions, and like that. And yet they were wrong. But at a certain point, the director of the school said this to me. You are considered our most disruptive student in the history of this school. I said, why? Well, because you're asking questions. Do any of the other students ask questions? No. Well, here's how it goes, Gary. Keep your mouth shut. Learn what they have to tell you. Get your grades and get out. then do what you want to do. Because no one can control how you're going to use the information you've learned. And I said, you realize, outside of some basic sciences, which are good, in anatomy and organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry and physiology, all this other on nutrition, I would disagree with. And she said, that's fine, disagree with it. So now imagine that you're a student and you're taking a class in political science. And the class in political science refuses to acknowledge that there are any other truths except what the textbook says and what they believe. Then you have a choice. Go beyond what the teacher is teaching you to discover other choices, other realities, and incorporate them into your life. And that way, you have broadened out your education. If the only education you get is what the teacher shares with you and what the textbook says, then you run the risk that there's a limitation or a bias or an agenda. And that is where a lot of students are ending up being shortchanged. And with the pressures in a lot of schools and the pressures to get high grades, high marks, what is the likelihood that a student goes in to do an essay and the essay goes against what the teacher has taught? Do you think they're going to get a good grade? I doubt it. So there's an enormous temptation to comply, to go along with, to fit in, just get out of the system. But then what happens when we become a journalist for a newspaper and you're told Andrew Wakefield is a nut job, a fraud, a criminal? And instead of looking at the facts and who the accuser is and what the actual circumstances are, you start with the idea that, okay, this guy's a bad guy. Now let me talk with some people who can verify that, confirm that. And then I got my story. Once you start compromising, where do you stop? Once you stop looking for the truth, where do you begin? And if nothing else, we have gotten to a point in many areas of our society where we refuse to see if there's any value, any validity, any truth in any other belief system. We become protective of what we have been told or taught or learned. We would like to think that we live by pure science, that every doctor wakes up each day with the sole purpose of enhancing the well-being and finding the best therapies for their patients. And then we run into reality. And how do we change that? Paradigms don't change. Individuals can. Hope that answers the question.
Thanks, Gary.
Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners all over the world. And from our sister station, PFW in Washington, D.C., KPFK in Los Angeles, and all the other stations. My guest in this segment of our program is Dr. Gilbert Welch. We're going to talk about the epidemic of overdiagnosis in American medicine, which in turn can lead to overtreatment, overtesting, and what then comes from that. Dr. Welch is a nationally recognized expert on the effects of medical screening. He is a professor of medicine at Dartmouth University Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, and he is the director of the Center for Medicine and the Media there. And he is also the author, with two other colleagues, of Overdiagnosis, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Welch.
It's nice to be with you.
Just today, from Reuters, is this, quote, up to half of the U.S. have pre-existing conditions, so says a study. 129 million Americans under the age of 65 have medical problems, putting them at risk of being rejected by insurance companies or having to pay more for coverage, according to government study reported in the Washington Post. That's one. Separately today, we're also told by a separate study that virtually an epidemic of children in the United States have mental illness but are not being properly treated. Then we have 11 million children who woke up this morning who are taking some form of medication. And then we have a whole group of Americans who are told that, well, you have conditions like social anxiety disorder, or you have adult defiance disorder, and you better have it treated. I'm concerned, and this is where we begin our journey with you, I'm concerned that not only are we over-diagnosing people, but we also have pathologized parts of life that at any other time in history and anywhere else would have been considered normal behavior, that today we have a need to categorize it, quantify it, commodify it, and commercialize it. So if you show us that we are overdiagnosed, then how did we get here? And what are the consequences of being overdiagnosed? The forum is yours.
Well, let me first say that all the numbers you report are only moving one direction. They're moving up. And this is my concern about the system about in which I'm a part. And I should start by saying I'm a conventionally trained physician. And I'm actually a believer in medical care. There's a lot of times when I believe medical care does a lot of good things. But we have increasingly moved into the population I call the well. And we've been looking at them increasingly harder and harder to see if we can find something wrong. And that's what this book deals with, this effort to, you know, to find disorders early in people with some of the best of intentions has this side effect of making people sick. And if we look at any of us hard enough, we will find things wrong. And as our technologies get more powerful and they're used more frequently in people, that leads to the kind of numbers that you were describing in the introduction of more people being told that somehow something is wrong. They're given a diagnosis. And what I want is I want people to be a little bit skeptical about this. My colleagues and I call this healthy skepticism. And that is to recognize that it may not always be in your best interest to look for things to be wrong.
Okay, then let's go through that. Show us where you believe we are most overdiagnosed. But one extension of that concept, I believe, this is my own personal belief, that we should have no-fault medical care in the United States, that no doctor or nurse or hospital should be sued, but rather anyone who is the victim of any mistreatment, overtreatment, or ends up suffering, there should be a compensation program set aside to help them, to treat them, so that we're not over-diagnosing. And that's something that we are doing, and the statistics and science shows that, and there's a consequence to that. And it's not as if, okay, so we're over-treating and over-diagnosing, but there's no consequence. Yes, there is. Could you take us there, and do you believe that we would benefit if we had no-fault medical care, as we have no-fault auto insurance?
Well, I think we'd have to consider that a little bit more carefully. I know all my colleagues would love the idea of no-fault medical care. That's not so much what I am arguing for in this book, although I certainly have to acknowledge that the legal system is viewed as punishing us only one direction. We're punished for underdiagnosis. We're never punished for overdiagnosis. And as long as that exists, that's a very powerful force, always pushing physicians to do more and to look harder. You asked me, you know, where do I think this is most relevant and important to people? I should say that, you know, when I started in this area, my concern was all about cancer screening. And my first book dealt solely with the topic of cancer screening, and that is the effort to look in people who have no symptoms for evidence of early cancer. And over the years, we've demonstrated a number of cancers that what's happening is as we look harder for cancer, we find more cancers. A lot of those cancers turn out not to matter, but we're never sure which one, so we end up treating a lot more people for cancer. And that is, you know, perhaps the most dramatic example of the problem of overdiagnosis. But in this book, I deal with cancer as well, but I expand the problem because I think it now pervades all of medical care. Whether it's conditions defined by numbers, things like who has high blood pressure, who has high cholesterol, who has osteoporosis, who has diabetes, all those conditions that I've listed, we've actually changed the definition of what constitutes abnormal over the past two decades. And that has a similar effect of telling more people that they're, quote, at risk or something is wrong. It starts more people on therapy and starts people who are sort of at the margin, people whose risks are really not very high, but all of a sudden they become patients and they also suffer from the side effects of therapy. And the reality is all of our therapies have some harms. And you certainly want therapy if you are at elevated serious danger from the condition or you're experiencing symptoms now. But you might not want it if you're just about average. And this is the kind of problem we're moving into, which is you say when, 50% of the population is told something is wrong, all of a sudden the balance of benefits and harms gets a lot tighter.
Let's take a look at mammography.
Sure.
And the number of women who would be able to, I think it's 1 in 2,000, I could be wrong on that statistic, would benefit by having a tumor discovered that could save their life. But then look at the number of women who would end up having mammography where they would end up believing or the physician believed that they have a problem and then being overtreated and ended up with serious medical consequences. Why aren't we having the discussion in an open and civil way, bringing in the people who have actually done the work? I remember Dr. Goffman, who was one of the world's leading authorities on the effects of radiation and diagnostic tools. He was excluded from these conversations. I believe that we should have all points of view, and so we really know what are the risk-benefit ratios. And yet, it's just not that. We don't have these debates. We have one side only. Your thoughts?
Well, obviously, I'm trying to contribute to a more balanced debate, and mammography is exactly the place where we very much need a more balanced debate. And to be fair, I would say the debate is getting more balanced than it would have been in the past. But mammography is certainly a topic I deal with in the book. And I don't think there's one right decision for women to make. I think there's different right decisions for different women. And women at the same risk of developing breast cancer can make different decisions based on how they feel about the various outcomes. But you do have the numbers just about right. For a 50-year-old woman that undergoes mammography for 10 years, it looks like somewhere around 1 in 2,000 one person in 2,000 will actually benefit from undergoing mammography. That means 1,999 did not benefit. A lot of those women go through an awful lot of anxiety as they have abnormal films, get repeat exams or biopsies, and a portion of those women, and that's something we're still working on exactly how many, but it looks like it's around 5 to 10 in 2,000, among those 2,000 women, will be treated for breast cancer unnecessarily, and that's no fun. That means radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy. There's no right answer to this question. The only right answer is to tell people the truth and tell them that these are close calls and that they have to be engaged in the decision themselves.
I would agree with that, and I think that your point is not only valid but reasonable. My concern is that we're not always dealing with industries that are in the business of selling physicians, you know, their drugs or their medical equipment. And once you start getting advanced technologies and diagnostic tools, then the question is, what do we leave out of the equation when a doctor visits with a person? Shouldn't we also consider everything that we can about the person's mental state and diet and the environment they're living in? If we relegate everything to just the patient is there because they believe something is wrong and this equipment, this technology is going to diagnose it, then I don't believe that we're serving the patient in the most comprehensive way, and that can also lead to problems. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first, I agree with your general thrust that we often focus too narrowly and don't consider the broader patient. I'm less concerned about the patient who thinks there's something wrong. What I'm most concerned about is the patient, and I wouldn't even like to call them a patient, the individual who feels well and yet is being drawn in to this testing, this effort to find something wrong. That is the part of medicine that's got me most concerned. I think it's a totally different kettle of fish when patients feel that something's wrong. That's a good time to go to medical care, and it may not always be done as well as it could be, but the big thrust of this book and my concern is about us inviting people in to medical care when they feel well, and that's become an increasing part of American medical care. And I think this problem is that if we really look hard at people to find something wrong, we will be successful an awful lot of the time. And in doing so, we may scare people, and we may initiate therapies that hurt them. And I think people need to understand that balance.
I would agree. My biggest concern right now is in the intentional marketing of children under Teen Screen and other programs. I interviewed the parents of a young girl, 16 years of age, who didn't tell her parents she was taking a Teen Screen out in Indiana. And she answered two of the questions in this way. Do you feel comfortable being around people in a party environment? She said no. And she said that she spends a lot of time at home because she likes to keep her room organized and neat. She was arrested. She was taken without the ability to resist to a mental institution. She was kept there for 6 months. Multiple therapies were given to her, drug therapies, and they were going to give her electroconvulsive therapy. Why? Because she was diagnosed because of a Teen Screen questionnaire she filled out. They said that her not wanting to be around people with social anxiety disorder and her wanting to keep a clean room at home was that she was a compulsive person. She suffered. And mind you, this is a real situation. This actually happened.
Absolutely.
And that concerns me.
You're describing sort of the medicalization of everyday life, where everyone can get a psychiatric diagnosis. And I think people are kind of familiar with that problem. And what I'm saying is that general problem also exists in what most people consider, if you will, hard diseases. In cancer, we have a boundary issue in cancer. There are people who have cells that meet the pathologic definition of and criteria for cancer, but they will never be bothered by them. And it's the fact that all the disorders we look for in medicine exist on some spectrum. There are people who are clearly diseased, and there are people who are clearly well, but there's a lot of people in between. And we're increasingly going after those people. And those are the people that for whom the benefit of looking for these things becomes very small, and yet the risks of the harms of treatment are nonetheless still there. And so the balance becomes much more tenuous. I do want to say you've mentioned money a couple of times, and I should certainly acknowledge that some of this problem is about money. I mean, one of the quickest ways for a pharmaceutical company or a company that makes testing equipment, one of the quickest ways for them to expand their markets is to expand the number of people who are eligible or are, quote, indicated to receive the test or the treatment. That is a very, very strong incentive for overdiagnosis. I should also say that there's a group of true believers who are not motivated by money, who genuinely believe that early diagnosis is the way we're going to solve all our problems. You know, we'll make the population healthier, and then some even believe we will save money. Nothing could be further from the truth. If we look hard for disease, we will all of a sudden find that, you know, most of the population harbors some abnormalities that will trigger treatment. Some people will be hurt along the way, and it will certainly not save money. It will only cost money.
I appreciate the work you and your colleagues have done. Thank you very much for sharing this with us. The book is called Overdiagnosis, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. My guest, Professor Gilbert Welch. Thank you very much, sir. We're out of time. Professor of Medicine at Dartmouth University. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.